let's do an MLB panel. We're going to have a little general baseball talk, and we'll get to Mets in a little bit. I'll bring on each of the two guests. First of all, from Deadspin, Hannah Kaiser. And then we've got, from Sports Illustrated, a fellow Baseball Prospectus alum, and I should say that if you go to Pacific Standard, which is a great bar in Brooklyn, and it has, like, couches and books and stuff in the back, there's a copy of Baseball Prospectus, I want to say, like, 06? 06. And because we're assholes, Jay Jaffe and I have signed that book. It's actually sitting in the back. Jay Jaffe.
I was 16 in 06.
Don't do that to me.
I actually was there. Was at Pacific Standard a couple weeks ago, and I checked in, and our baby's still there.
Yes. Amazing. So we're going to do just a few questions. I think we'll get to you guys, and then we're going to jump off to the Mets. One thing, I want to start with you. We talked a little bit about this, like, backstage. You've done some really cool enterprise feature kind of stuff. Fair to say?
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And
it's fair for you to say. If I said it, that would be obnoxious.
No.
Thank you for saying it.
Self-aggrandizement is the key to journalism. You have to embrace this. You can't be humble in this business. Yeah, anyway.
I didn't even know we got free drinks.
You did.
I've been paying for my drinks.
Oh, my God. Wow, you're doing this all wrong. Anyway, so one piece that you did, it talks about Cuban smugglers and the idea of you get these guys, and they get like Puig, and you get guys who come up, and they're very successful. Sometimes there's a lot of backstory, but the stakes can be really high regardless, and in some cases, these guys don't even make it. So they're literally risking their lives, beholden to these smugglers and all these things, and they might not even get anything out of it. And I guess maybe the general way to get at it is this, and also just, I feel like we talk about Noah Syndergaard and Clayton Kershaw, we talk about people who make it, but it feels like in baseball, between minor leaguers who aren't represented and don't make real money, between Cuban players who have to risk their lives for maybe nothing, frankly, it's easy to get disenfranchised in this game, I guess.
Yeah, this is not going to be as funny as Hank was.
That's all right. Journalism counts.
This
good.
It's tough to be funny about talking about Cuban smuggling. So there was just a Cuban smuggling trial. We actually had a wonderful freelancer down in Miami who was covering that, but I did some pieces on that beforehand and followed it. And the issue there is that no one is seemingly trying to do evil. So the trial was the guys who help Cuban baseball players get out of Cuba and establish residencies in third countries so that way they can come to America bypassing the draft so they can sign for larger bonuses in the international pool. Which probably actually, if you want to get back to what's wrong with it, it's that you need to have international, because otherwise they would just come to America and then they'd be able to sign there, but then they'd have to go in the draft. And I spoke to some lawyers before at that trial. Actually, those people were found guilty, so
is that good?
Well, it's more interesting because we'll have to see now what happens with major league executives, because it came up in that trial that there's, you know, like totally no way that MLB doesn't realize that this is happening illegally, because...
So, like, is Brian Cashman going to jail?
he was not in the trial. Some of the Rangers execs were in the trial.
Really?
Yes, they testified in the trial saying that they had no idea, even though whenever they get players from Cuba, they all have, like, the same job in Haiti. It's like, yeah, there's just, like, 10 Cuban guys working as, like, whittlers in Haiti, and they just moved there last month. I have no idea why that happened. And so they get these real papers, or fake papers, but then MLB says, well, if the papers say they live in Haiti, that we didn't do anything wrong if we signed them. And so that trial is interesting because we'll see what happens next. But it's also, it creates these problems where sometimes guys leave Cuba, they've defected, they can't get back, and they become fake whittlers in Haiti. And then if they don't sign with anyone, they just have no country anymore, and they get sort of left behind, and the smugglers don't make any money off them, so, you know, at least it was a bust in that sense. but it's sort of sad. Right?
It's very
I don't know.
Sad.
That's pretty
Are we
sad.
Supposed to applaud?
Sorry, somebody make a joke.
No, it's, and that's why, and you know, we talked about the minor leagues, and it's, you just get to this point where there are so many people that just get pushed down for the really successful to
succeed. The only active minor league player who was participating in the collective, the suit against MLB just asked the Mets to release him like a week ago, I think.
Wow.
So yeah, there's a class action suit. Minor league baseball players are suing MLB for fair wages because they make way, way, way below minimum wage. And there was only one guy who was going to deal with the awkwardness of like playing baseball while suing MLB. And just this year, like at the end of spring training, so like a week ago, asked to be released. So now that's a whole bunch of players, but they're all former players who are suing for like back wages.
Yeah, Garrett Brosius is an interesting follow on Twitter. I think it's just @bro, which is like B-R-O-S-H-I-U-S, and he talks about this a lot. And this has come up, the NCAA has been a big issue now because you've got the dudes who just played last night, none of them are getting paid, everybody else is getting paid.
Yes, but haven't you heard? They love it.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
I love this, and if they didn't pay me, I wouldn't do it. Not this, I'm not getting paid for this. I mean, like, the writing thing. I mean, the writing thing.
You got paid? What?
That's why I don't get free drinks.
Jay, I am a big fan of your bold predictions column.
Oh, thank you.
Yes. And I love the fact that they make us make predictions every year because they set us up to fail.
You know, when you think about baseball being a game of failure, I think this is the closest we get to that analogy as writers. Is like, you know, we are put in the position of having to say things that are maybe a little bit more outlandish, you know, or just like project like what's going to happen this season. Look, if I actually knew what the fuck was going to happen, would I be writing for the wages I'm writing? No, I would be in Las Vegas making money on that. So anyway, what Jonah's alluding to here is ever since I've been at Sports Illustrated, which goes back to 2012, I've started the second half of the season with a bold predictions for the second half, which is usually one of my most popular columns of the year. And this time around, my editor said, hey, why don't we get Jay Jaffe to be wrong earlier in the season? Because it's, you know, let's just have people pelting him with eggs all year long. And so, you know, this time around, that's what we did. So
yeah, anyway. We always do previews at Deadspin, and last year we didn't even, like, start them, I think, until May. Which made us look really correct in comparison to everybody else. This year, the guest opening day was 2 days ago, and we have 10 of 30 on the site.
I think my favorite running Deadspin thing now is...
White Sox?
Yes. Tim Marchman, who's the editor of Deadspin, who's great, great guy, all that good stuff, and a very talented writer and editor, but he just writes mundane things about the White Sox, but
and
tinged with horrible
sadness.
And
it's driving people crazy because they think there's a punchline that they don't get. The actual White Sox emailed him.
No.
Yes. They were like, are we the butt of this joke? And he was like, no, I'm
a White Sox fan.
And they were like, oh, okay, we're going to send you some gear then.
Oh, that's good.
I know. Where are the ethics?
It's about ethics and journalism. Second most home runs ever last year. I took a crack at this this past week, although I wrote the story after Mike Petriello did, so technically, according to recent events, that would put me in big trouble. But anyway, some of you know what I'm saying. Anyway, what gives? I mean, like, you wrote a great piece a little while back about how the steroids era turned out to be the juiced ball era. And Ben Lindbergh and Rob Arthur took a crack at that and said, no, we don't think it's that this time. But maybe it is, or maybe it's ballparks, or maybe it's the common conceit seems to be guys are trying to hit home runs, which sounds great, but then why didn't guys try to hit home runs before? I wrote a whole column about it. I'm still not sure what the answer is. You have a theory?
I think what we've seen, and this is something that goes back to, if you study, you know, when we talk about the steroid era, and this is something I did first back in 2005, for Will Carroll's book, right when all the PED stuff was exploding, the hearing in front of Congress, and then revisited in 2012 for the Baseball Prospectus book, Extra Innings. You know, when you look back at the point of inflection for home run rates in Major League Baseball, you get this weird spike in 1987. And then you get from 1993 to 2007, you get the sustained peak that is just beyond anything Major League Baseball had ever seen. And the thing is, when you study it, is okay. You know, it's commonly known as the steroid era, and the assumption is that steroids, you know, are what caused all the home runs. You know, and when you look obviously at the upper end of the you know, the record books with, you know, McGuire, Sosa, and Bonds, yes, there may have been something there. but you don't. You've got so many other confounding factors. If you try to study this and unravel it, it literally becomes a yarn. The constitution of the baseball changed somewhere in there, and there's all kinds of interesting tales to be had in there, many of which require a much better journalist than I ever was to try to track down. But I think what you've got is a perfect storm. There was so much change in baseball, ballparks, conditioning, not just with PEDs, but just the general realization that strength training is something that could benefit even your 160-pound shortstop. Ballparks at altitude, not just Denver, but also Arizona, which is more than 1,000 feet above sea level and is now the second highest elevation in the sport. It's very tough to try to pinpoint a single factor. And like what Ben and Rob did, talking to physicists, talking to it's bewildering how the way they studied it, you get to a sort of a paradox where, it could be this, but we don't have enough evidence to show that it's one thing. I think it's literally, multiple factors contributing to it at once. People, the players in the game have figured out that there is maybe more upside to be had in changing their approach as part of it. So I don't think you can isolate a single factor.
One last question, this on here, and then we'll get some questions from you guys. And we'll start with you, because you did a video on this, on knuckleballers. I love the knuckleball. Statheads love knuckleballs, because we think that, it's a way to beat the system. And the argument seems to be, it's hard to throw a knuckleball because nobody's around to teach a knuckleball because nobody else ever threw a knuckleball. What did you learn when you did that feature, which was really great, by the way, for Dead?
I cannot throw a knuckleball. I learned that I cannot throw a knuckleball. I did a video with Stephen Wright, who's, I think, the only one. Who else? Anyone else throwing a knuckleball that you know? Or Dickie. Oh, my God. Sorry, Mets fans. My grandma loves him, too. She has his book, and she's always like, tell R.A., She thinks I like know all the baseball players, but no. So I learned that the hard part of throwing a knuckleball is that you have to do the same thing every time while sort of doing the different thing. If you throw it in exactly the same place every time, then it's a very easy pitch to hit. Also, that nobody teaches it, and that you have to have very big hands. I cannot throw a knuckleball. Can you?
What is the stat head's opinion? Is this a lot caused because we can't teach it, or should it be every team should just
I think teams should be cultivating it. I think one of the really interesting things back when theory of what's called DIPS, defense independent pitching stats, the idea that major league pitchers don't differ greatly on their abilities to prevent hits on balls in play, which is the exact wording of how you need to frame that. I've memorized it. I may have it tattooed on my body somewhere. You'll have to get me very drunk if you want to find out.
Pitch talks after dark.
But one of the more interesting things about it was that while the Pedro Martinez's and the Greg Maddox's of the world, even them, they fluctuate from year to year in terms of the batting averages on balls in play. The knuckleballers, by which it was a very small sample size, but like guys like Tim Wakefield and before him, Tom Candiotti. Those guys seem to be able to suppress batting average on balls in play. Now, granted, at any given time over the last 40 years, there've really only been a couple knuckleballers in the league at any given time. I think that knowing what we know, every team should be cultivating two or three knuckleball prospects somewhere to try to see if they can get one to break through. Stephen Wright of the Red Sox had great success last year. He is maybe the third or so Red Sox prospect they've tried to cultivate as a knuckleballer. Wakefield broke through after kind of failing as a minor league infielder. They had a guy named Charlie Zink. There's a whole New Yorker article about him. Stephen Wright was a success story, but it took him forever to break through, and he's now got some injury problems. But I think every team should be doing that. I think it's just you've got five minor league teams or six minor league teams. Of course you should be having, trying to cultivate a knuckleballer. You should have a catcher who knows how to catch the damn thing.
And hopefully not someone who's as bad as Josh Tolley. I feel like the Blue Jays still and the Mets. I'm sorry. If Josh Tolley's in the room, I apologize. I think we're only going to do like three questions because we want to jump to the next panel. So let's see if we can get a couple in there, if that's possible. I literally can't see anything, but I assume Kevin has a microphone.
First.
Hi, everybody. So first of all, you mentioned how hard it is physically to throw a knuckleball.
Maybe not if you throw other pitches more regularly than
right.
I do.
But you need big hands. You need certain physical attributes. And then you were saying how teams should cultivate a certain number of knuckleballers per system. And I'm just wondering, in my experience, guys like R.A. Dickey, Jim Boughton, these guys were basically on their last legs. They had nothing else to lose. And I was just wondering if you think it's still possible, given that, that really this is people's like last-ditch attempt at pitching. If I were a pitcher, I'd be like, fuck that, I'm not throwing a knuckleball. I would not be interested in even learning that skill. Do you still think that there'd be a willingness in teams, systems to maybe take on this new skill if they didn't absolutely have to?
Well, why wouldn't they?
Minor league systems, major league teams have no shortage of guys whom they're about to pink slip. Not just pitchers, but the infielder who had a good arm or the outfielder who had a good arm, who was a two-way player in high school or college, who took the road that they thought was going to make it to the major leagues and that washed out. Yeah, systems are full of them. Everybody's got a few of them lying around.
Yeah, one of the things that Wright said was that you can throw a knuckleball if you've ever thrown a knuckleball. At some point they'll be like, oh, we saw you playing around with that, and if you can do it once, we will try to get you to do that if you have no other options left. And why not? My dad told me when I was little that we were watching TV and he was like, if you can throw left-handed, you can make it in the major leagues. And I took him literally and tried to learn to throw left-handed. If he had said, if you can throw a knuckleball, you can probably be a pitcher, I probably would have practiced that more.
My daughter is left-handed. We're actively trying to teach her the knuckleball. She's seven. One thing I want to say, it's true. My son sucks. He's a lost cause. Shout out to Ellis. One thing that I always wonder about, Mike Mussina didn't throw a knuckleball, but he threw a spike curve. He threw a knuckle curve. And I feel like there are elements of the knuckleball that even if you're not, hey, I got a fastball, slider, changeup, and I also throw a knuckleball, why can't you kind of mess around with knuckleball-adjacent strategies? I feel like that could be a little easier to teach. Mussina's a Hall of Fame pitcher in my mind, a great pitcher. But maybe it's something that can be sent down to other generations or whatever. I'd like to see that because that was a devastating weapon. One of the best pitches of the last generation was his knuckle curve. A couple more.
Jonah, you've written a lot about economics and baseball. You wrote about the Chargers moving to L.A. and
fuck Dean Spanos.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. Well, with that and the Marlins and fuck Jeff Loria.
Yeah.
The Expos seem to need public money to move back, to get a team in Montreal. You and all three of you, what are your views on having public money?
Is this a plant?
It is. I'm involved. What's the conflict? What's the view on getting the Expos back? Because I'm conflicted. How do we get the Expos back and deal with the public money issue?
Okay, so
Kickstarter.
The Kickstarter would be good. If you think about the math, especially with the exchange rate now, you need either relocation or expansion. You need to build a stadium, and you include the exchange rate. It's probably $2 billion Canadian to get a team to Montreal, realistically. That's a lot. This is going to be really super dorky inside baseball. Sure. Probably the right audience. In Quebec, taxes are higher. Income taxes in particular are higher. Income taxes on the top bracket are very, very high. We don't have Paul Ryans running around trying to cut everybody's high taxes. So the end result is that rich people pay a lot of money. So athletes would pay a lot of money. The only way that I'm okay with public taxpayer money, public money for a stadium, is if it's money that did not exist in another realm. So if you had ballplayers suddenly come in and make money for playing baseball, and you took their tax money, which would not exist, and you put it toward a team or a stadium, all right, I can get behind that. That is the only scenario in which I'm okay with that, and that uniquely seems to exist in Quebec or, I suppose, France. If they wanted to play there, that would also be fine. So as long as it's French. So That's the only way. That still leaves a gigantic gap of a whole bunch of money that needs to come from other places. Well, you don't necessarily, you know, Tampa and Minnesota and Oakland, you've had teams in recent history who have had small payrolls and they haven't had to attract free.
Yeah, but Tampa doesn't have high income tax.
No, but separate from that, what I'm saying is they didn't attract free agents and they still won. You don't need to attract free agents to win in baseball. You can be homegrown and what, I mean, the Yankees in the 90s, when they were at their best, they won with through homegrown guys. So that's not a major concern. It's you still have to be able to build the team. So I think it is potentially doable. The deal, and the other deal with the Expos or Montreal team in particular, is that the majority owner would be a company called Bell. Bell is like if AT&T and ESPN had a baby, basically. There's two of those in Canada. One is Sportsnet. They own the Blue Jays. They also employ me. God bless Sportsnet. And the Jays are wildly successful and they throw off crazy cash. Bell would be the second citizen because the team in Montreal wouldn't be as big as the team in Toronto, but it would be doable and they could potentially self-fund it. So there is a scenario where it could happen and not have to actually take it out of people who are, whatever, normal people who live in the suburbs, hopefully. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you want to weigh in. Obviously, we all agree the taxpayer money.
I don't have a ton to add except in the United States. I mean, there's just, people are so reluctant to have anything that increases their taxes, even when it's their own goddamn children's education. They don't want to pay for that. They don't want to pay for healthcare. They don't want to pay for anything. There's no rational way to justify building a stadium to attract a team or anything like that. It is a leap of irrationality that has to happen. And you know, from a rational standpoint, I can't advise that. But, you know, it happens, and you know, when it does happen and cities do get teams, you know, God bless them. I mean, go for it, whatever. Like, but just know that you're not getting the deal that you thought you were going to get, you know, from the people who set that up. And that is the story 110% of the time.
I think Loria poisoned the well, too. I think that once we've seen the grift, like, kind of fully exposed, like, we all know it's bad, but Loria is not good at PR at all, so.
Okay, Jonah, we're over here on your right.
Cool.
In the back.
One more. Well, Kevin, you could tell me how many more.
Hey, guys. Thanks for coming out and doing the panel tonight. Your comments about doing prediction articles got me thinking about the business and journalism side of the business. Is there ever a temptation or pressure from above within your organizations to write things that are outrageous or otherwise interesting in order to generate interest in the articles that may go against what you actually think may happen?
At Deadspin.
Have fun.
I recently wrote a piece, this is not baseball, about how women in, I believe, Finland are engaging in fake equestrian events on hobby horses. And I said, this is dumb. And my editor said, no, it's sweet. So, yes.
As somebody who has to do a number of these a year, I mean, I think anytime you're running, no matter what you're doing, you want to set yourself apart from the rest of the field. And you know innately, if you've survived in this business, that, you know, going with the favorites every time is not going to get you clicks. You're not that big a name. Nobody really cares whether you think the Red Sox are going to beat the rest of the AL East or whatever, or that you've got the Mets as the wild. I mean, like, it's just not that interesting unless you find some way to do a twist in there. Now, with the bold predictions column, which has become something of a tradition at SI, I mean, I've been encouraged from the outset. You got to throw something in there that's gonna, like, you know, that's got a wrinkle in it, you know, whether it's like something that's completely impossible, that's not going to happen, or something that is just, you know, throwing darts. Because you know that nobody's coming to you to tell you that the team that's leading the division at the first half is going to bring it home. They want you to pull something out of your ass and say, like, yes, of course the Tampa Bay Rays are going to go on a run and win 32 games in a row. And make the playoffs. You've got to come up with something like that, and that's just the reality of the industry, the competitive industry as we face. Now, if I'm going to do something like that, it has to be something that first and foremost entertains me. Because if it does actually break through, it's something that's going to be connected to me for the rest of the year. So, you know, I need to be entertained by it. I'll bounce it off a couple friends, too, like, or my, and my editor, like, what do you think of this? And, you know, that's just part of life. And now, the lucky thing is with predictions, I mean, if, you know, if you're wrong, nobody really remembers except Royals fans or Orioles fans, which have, you know, memories like elephants. But the rest of it, you know, I think, like, those are, like, tend to be, fortunately, fairly disposable. Now, if, to write an article, like a feature on somebody where you don't really believe that, you know, Starling Castro is going to be the next Derek Jeter or something like that, you know, I think I would feel very differently about that if I was being pushed to do an article like that.
I have a wildly different answer than both of you, actually.
Yeah, actually, nobody actually pressured. The hobby horse example aside, they let me write what I want.
I only became a full-time sports writer in 2011. I used to be a business writer, and from the moment that I've been a sports writer, which was Grantland for 4 years and 117 jobs now, I've never, nobody's ever said you should write this thing or you know, this is the, nobody's ever set a mandate. Super lucky. I don't know how or why I've been granted this luxury, but it's never come up. I write what I want, and I just try to make it smart, and it's worked out. So I'm super, super lucky in that way. That might be atypical. That might not be a normal answer for you. It happens that that's been my experience. Kevin, what do you want to do? One more?
That's it.
That's it, says Wrap Kevin. It okay, so we're going to play, first of all, thank you to Hannah Kaiser and to Jay Jaffe.